Hey, welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to this edition of the Hagman and Hagman Report. If we got somebody for you, I'm going to tell you something. If you don't, if within the next hour, if you don't learn anything, shame on you. Because, and if you're not excited by the end of this hour, shame on you. We are a good friend, a new friend, but a good friend, Jeffrey Ludwig. He's a guy that who's taught at Harvard, Penn State, and the University of New York. Theron Fellow in International History at London School of Economics. Wait, there's more. He's written numerous articles about U.S. history, the Middle East, and most specifically American education. Now, he's written a couple of books. This one in particular just knocked my socks off.
This one we're going to be getting into tonight.
Okay, I'm going to tell you something. See, I even have little tabs in there. I had to fold some back so no one could see. But the catastrophic decline of American public high schools, New York City, a case study. Let me tell you something. This book, we wonder how we got where we're at, why we're here, why we're staying here, where we're going. This will tell you everything you want to know. Again, our guest is Jeffrey Ludwig. Jeffrey Ludwig, thank you so much for being part of our show tonight.
Well, good evening to you and to Joe, to both of you. I'm just so pleased and delighted to be here and to share this time with you and your listeners and your viewers. And thanks for all those nice compliments about my book.
Last night, my wife.
Did you lose my picture? No, okay.
No. It was about 3:30 in the morning, and I couldn't sleep, and I'm over in the rocking chair in our bedroom, and I've got the light on, and I thought it was dim, and I hear this, "What are you doing?" Well, you know, from the other side, from the bed. And I'm reading your book, okay? She said, "Stop reading, come to bed. Come back to bed." Anyway, I went up to the guest room and finished, continued reading. But what a fascinating book. But you talk a lot about education in defense of the traditional values of promoting knowledge, creativity, character building, and such. Let's get started. Let's get started on the book, on your findings, and what's going on with American education.
Fine, very good.
But where do you want to start? How did we get here, I guess, is one of the first questions I've gotten, and we get a lot, is how did we get to this point with our education system? How did it get so broken?
Well, there are so many different views about that, Doug, but I think the story really begins in the 1960s. There was the 1960s saw a kind of cultural nervous breakdown, and at that time there were, you know, especially in higher education, there was the Vietnam War protests, there was the drug subculture, the idea of tune in, turn on, and drop out from the Leary and Alpert. These were two Harvard professors who were fired from Harvard, actually, because they were promoting a drug culture on campus, and that wasn't acceptable at that time. I don't know if it would be acceptable now or not, but I know I was a student at that time, and one of their acolytes invited me to a session where I could drop acid with them. Get out of my normal sense of reality and get to a different place in my mind that's more real than everyday life. But I'm just thankful to God Almighty that I had the good sense to refuse the invitation. Amen. And so all of this, combined with the fact that Eastern religion started to get promoted more in the 19th century, Ralph Waldo Emerson and the other transcendentalists were promoting Eastern Hindu religion, even in the United States. He had dropped out of being a minister, a Unitarian minister, and had gone the path of theosophy, it was called.
That's true.
And that was Hindu meditation and stuff like that. So that world exploded in the 1960s, and especially the Vietnam War became the center for a lot of anti-authority dogma coming in. The authorities want to kill you. The authorities don't care about Vietnam. And all of this left-wing interpretation of the war started. And the students became very fractious. And basically it was tolerated.
Gotcha.
And,
yeah.
The end result was that we have a breakdown of order and a breakdown of a feeling that if you go through school and you work and you have your family, that this is a kind of antiquated, and something new has to come in to replace it. And that spirit of wanting to replace the tried and true that had taken America through hundreds of years, from its colonial phase in through its formative years, and then even as through the 1940s and 50s, that started to break down, and feeling there must be something new. There's got to be something better than this thing of going through and getting your high school diploma and then moving on and moving on and having a normal life. And normalcy came into question. That's really my main point.
Exactly. Okay.
So the counterculture.
The counterculture, yeah.
In that the time period where that took place is the beginning of the end for the educational system in this country.
You know, and if you don't mind, one of the very first sections I marked in your book was on page, I think it was in the introduction. Once prayer was removed from the schools, schools became one-stop social agencies. In many cases, the family began to decline as a building block of society. Loco parentis gave way to the reverse formula, where families are called upon to support the mission of the schools instead of schools supporting the mission of the family, and so on. You continue there, and the notation, of course, is that meaning of the First Amendment Establishment Clause changed over several decades, which I think is so important that people don't understand that. But prayer in the public schools was abolished in the cases of Engel versus Vitale in 62, Murray v. Curlett in 63, and Abington County School District versus Shemp in 63 as well. That's where it all began, didn't it?
Well, I've read studies, Doug, I've read studies, probably you have as well, showing, you know, that addiction, crime, and the divorce rate, even so many of these social ills really started to accelerate in the 60s. So although you can make a scientific case that there's a direct link with the elimination of prayer in the schools, intuitively it just makes sense to me when I see the 60s climbing and all these negative statistics. And we know that prayer in the schools had to have a salutary effect upon the minds of the youth coming up. When you hear Psalm 23 read so many times, before I became a Christian, I already knew Psalm 23 by heart, and I never resented being asked to read or know Psalm 23, you know, and there it was planted in my mind. The Lord is my shepherd. I shall not want. And then at the end, that I may dwell in the house of the Lord forever and ever. You see, these thoughts, once they're planted as seeds in our minds, take root and they have consequences. And those are good thoughts and wonderful thoughts from God.
Amen.
And I think we lost so much. In fact, I heard a preacher recently who was poo-pooing the idea that we lost by having the having prayer in the school abolished in the 60s. He said, "Oh no, who wants to recite a prayer made by bureaucrats. Can you imagine? I heard this in a church.
Wow.
A guest preacher in a pulpit was putting down the idea that there had been a loss by eliminating prayer in the public schools. I couldn't believe my ears. But, you know, that's all part of the social fragmentation of our time.
It's only getting worse. You see, you know, these Satanist clubs are being enacted in different schools, and it's really a shame when you get the and when it comes to the prayer, when it's basically banned, Christian prayer is banned, the Word of God is banned in all public schools for the most part, and they are allowing, though, you know, these other New Age, satanic, and, you know, dark things to come in its place, and they're accepting of that. It is very backwards. But continuing,
well, I was teaching in high school. I'll just share this with you. At one point, a young lady who was teaching in the high school started dancing around the social studies office and chanting, "I don't have a soul. I don't have a soul." It was bizarre. And nobody remarked anything about it. I mean, there she was, and I don't even know what brought that on, you know, but it was a strange little chant that she just started doing. I think it was because I was there, and everybody knew I'm a born-again Christian, and was her way of flaunting her unbelief in front of me.
Okay, so she was kind of taunting you then, I take
it. I think so.
You didn't smack her like I probably would have. But, okay.
Well, he probably would have, too.
Yeah, I mean, anymore, wow. Wow, okay, all right, and folks are...
That's a weird little story.
Yeah, really. It's disturbing on many levels. Our guest, Jeffrey Ludwig, the book that we're talking about, and folks, this is a tremendous book, The Catastrophic Decline of America's Public High Schools, New York City, a case study. If so many emotions, I had so many emotions when I read this book. It's just an unbelievable. And of course, many articles from our guest can be found at American Thinkers, articles and blog posts by E. Jeffrey Ludwig at American Thinker. Some of the best, along with Peter Chalka and other. And I want to say thank you to Thomas Lipson as well for creating such a great website with so many great people.
Jeff, I really identify with him because he describes himself as a recovering academic, and as soon as I read that, I identified with that category.
Well, yeah, and I suspect many of us could, although I probably don't have the creds to do that, but you certainly do.
I want to jump in with some while we have Jeff, and while I'm remembering, there's been and I think this is pretty popular, we're pretty well known amongst our listeners, and if not, check it out. There's a test from, I think, 1908, an eighth grade test from 1908 that has been posted online. We've seen other examples like this from the 1800s to, you know, early 1940s. People will post tests from different grade periods to show the kind of work that was being done, you know, 100 years ago in schools. And when you look at that work and how complex it was versus what we see today, how is it that the education system has declined so much? Is it because government has gotten involved, or is it more targeted at conditioning people? Because it's startling differences from the, you know, 100 years.
Well, Joe, you have to remember this, that early in the 20th century, they were still very much under the sway of the great books tradition, where the educated people were expected to know things in a more classical way. This was before Dewey really took hold. Dewey and his followers, where they were promoting more of a practical and civic ideal of turning out masses of workers for the American factory system, and getting away totally from the great books ideal, that there was a body of knowledge and that everybody should be embracing, if they want to get an education, they must advance and grasp that body of knowledge. Whereas Dewey had a more, he was more practical in one sense, but, you know, he was, I hate to say he was anti-intellectual because he's on every side of every issue, but the basic thrust is in his book, A Common Faith. The idea is to integrate people into the workforce and to have happy drones who fit in so nicely with a secular, non-religious view, and they just take their little spot in the system that's allotted to them, and then they do it. And education is to prepare them for that, not to be thinking people. You see, in an earlier era, education was to be a thinking person, and of course to embrace the Bible as part of that. But Dewey revised that, not to be a thinking person per se, although a few enlightened people like himself could fit the bill, but to, you know, to fit in with your democratic, your position in a democracy. So the intellectual side of life was downplayed. And I don't want to just put it all at the feet of Dewey, but there were, the people bought into it. And Dewey, at one point, when he was at Columbia, in fact, when I was a grad student, one professor was boasting about this, that at one point, 70% of all the school superintendents in the United States had actually studied under Dewey, or the professors who had directly studied under Dewey. So I think I think a case can be made for this this shift in the overall philosophy of education that was being disseminated throughout the United States. A little bit after that 1908 period, they were still more with the intellectual tradition at that point.
Right.
But they moved away from it. By the 1920s, the move really started to pick up steam, and they published the Cardinal Principles of Education, which were not intellectual. They were not intellectual. There were intellectual aspects to it, but the goal was not a higher rationality. It wasn't an Aristotelian goal. The idea wasn't a higher spirituality. The idea wasn't a higher anything that had been traditional up to that point. The idea was go with the flow and be a useful citizen in a complex industrial society. Very different way of thinking.
Yeah,
I don't know if that will satisfy you or not, but I was concerned about the same thing. Why has that decline happened? And much of it, I became convinced, was because of this progressive education. They called it progressive education.
Isn't that interesting?
You're not surprised with that kind of labeling. They didn't call it brainy education. I don't know what the term was before. They just called it education was definitely linked to rationality.
And I just see. And yeah, you did explain that well. It's just, to me, when I look at things like that, and I saw, I think it was that test I referred to, and I read through it, and I'm thinking, wow, you know, we've gone from this to Common Core, and the, what is even considered a high school education at this point is just, there's nothing of substance there, and these people still don't know how to think critically. I mean, they're teaching them what they want them to learn, they're not teaching them how to learn, and, It's very dangerous.
And we come back to your the outline here that we have, which you mentioned, the Common Core, No Child Left Behind, the defense of traditional values of promoting knowledge, creativity, character building, and such, called the executive function in IQ tests, parental authority against mass manipulators, and so on. But here we are. No Child Left Behind, Common Core standards recently modified in violation of the 10th Amendment of our Constitution.
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, go ahead and expand on that if you don't mind.
Well, first of all, at least in the urban school systems, IQ tests aren't even given anymore. Really? Students don't get IQ tests. because IQ tests are considered to be biased against people of color and minority people and people who do not have...
That's insulting. It should be insulting to the minorities or the people of color, I would think.
Well, you know, it's so ironic because IQ tests were designed just like the SAT. The SAT for college admissions was designed originally so that all students, regardless of their ethnicity, would have a level playing field for showing that they had what it took to move on to a college environment.
Right.
And so that therefore there wouldn't be prejudice leveled against them because of race or, but mostly race was the issue. And, you know, it's reversed so much. And IQ tests weren't conceived of that way, you know, to give equality to all, but it was a measure of what is the best placement for an individual so that he or she can maximize his or her potential. It wasn't done because the race issue wasn't as important when the IQ test came in. So they set it up so that the brightest kids would, you know, they would have a different, more challenging kind of environment to work in than the kids who didn't have the high IQ, but, you know, they still, you know, they're human beings. Everybody's precious in the sight of God, and they would move ahead and maximize their potential. But then this got reversed in the 1960s. There was a very important article by George Jensen, Professor George Jensen, in the Harvard Educational Review, where he said that generally African Americans had a lower IQ than non-African Americans. And this was right at the same time as the civil rights movement had a full head of steam. And this created a tremendous backlash against not only George Jensen, but against IQ testing. And that's when it started to get, it's still done in various places, but in New York it's not done, and a lot of the big urban centers it's not done. But that Jensen's article, just coming at that time, created the backlash against not only him, but against IQ testing per se. And that's why it's fallen into disuse, in my opinion. That's the historical dynamic. But you know what? The executive function is a real thing. IQ is real. And I don't believe that people were using IQ tests to suppress black achievement. I really do not believe that because...
I don't even see how that's possible.
I don't see it.
Yeah.
I don't see it either, Doug.
Yeah.
It's one of these things that becomes a slogan among certain people. It's an exploited idea. And society is full of these manipulations. You know, I'm even reading about Charlemagne right now, way back in the 8th century. And there were so many manipulations, even in that time. It seems to be it's the name of the game. I don't want to sound too cynical, but it's the name of the game. You know, the political game is that some people want power at the expense of others, so they find different slogans, different avenues to break in and try to stir up trouble to get that other person in power, out of power, and so on. I just see it as a recurring theme.
Indeed. We're approaching the bottom of the hour break. Okay, we've got
about a minute and a half.
All right.
Our guest is Jeff Ludwig.
Yeah, I got to tell you, this book, The Catastrophic Decline of America's Public High Schools, New York City, A Case Study, will really awaken you to the significant changes, the problems, the issues that we're facing. Conversations about education are often Well, let me just tell you what. Go get yourself a copy of this book. You won't be sorry. You will not be sorry. This is a very well written book. I was just amazed by some of the information in there. Joe, I'm sorry. I lost my thought on that.
Isn't there an Oprah book club? Or she like
you know something?
You should have a Hagman book club sticker.
I'm going to do that. I am.
You should. He collects books.
I love reading.
In the office over there, there's the whole wall, floor to ceiling, just in a one area of bookshelves. And he does. He reads a lot of books.
I do. Sorry. Well, you know what? I'm not sorry. I'm not going to make any apologies for it. But
you know, that reminded me, back when I was in school, during the summertime, they used to give you these reading assignments where you had to read. Either they had a list of titles you got to choose a few from. Maybe it was three books in the summer. Or two books. I wonder if they still do that. It seems that schools have shied away from encouraging reading with the technological advances that are ongoing. We'll ask Jeff Ludwig when we return his book, Catastrophic Decline of the American Public High Schools or Schools? Public High Schools. Okay, thank you, Jeff. He is our guest. That is his
book.
I read
the book. He didn't.
One of his books. The other one is The Jewish American Christian. And I want to check that out. It's a probably an interesting read as well. But we'll be right back. Jeff's going to be with us throughout the next segment. Don't go anywhere. You're listening to this edition of the Hagman Report. Stay tuned.
Visit HagmanReport.com for the news and articles that matter most. Stay tuned. We will be right back.
Shall be great tribulation, such as was not since the beginning of the world to this time. No, nor ever shall be.
Folks, I'm going to direct your attention to MasterPreps.com. MasterPreps.com. Wow. MasterPreps.com, the sponsor of our show, MasterPreps.com. That's MasterPreps.com. Take a visit there. High-quality items, made-in-America items. I mean, anything, everything you possibly want, from cooking utensils, cooking frying pans. I mean, it is... It'll blow you away. Absolutely, Eric said.
It's insane. I mean, wow. Look at the products.
Folks, visit MasterPreps.com. Again, welcome to the Hagman Report family. MasterPreps.com. I mean, wow. It's insane.
MasterPreps.com. Are you ready for what comes next?
Hi, I'm Grace Gonzalez from Caring Close in the Woods. We are an American family-owned company founded and built on skills and knowledge gained from responding to 18 major disasters in the U.S. and around the world. We found that most people don't have enough food and water to survive, let alone any medicinals to save their life. We are offering 25% off our must-have American Heritage Remedies kit. It contains 12 homeopathic remedies, a booklet that goes over everything in your kit, and our brand new book, Major Disasters Lessons Learned. Just enter coupon code HAGMAN. In life or a disaster, you must be able to take care of yourself. You may not be a medical doctor, and your grandmother and your great-grandmother probably weren't either. But they still knew how to minister to their family's health issues. And so can you. Check out our American Heritage Remedies Kit at www.changeclosethewoods.com. Your life may depend on it.
Hello, everyone. This is Joe Charles, the guy whose voice is heard announcing for the Hagman and Hagman Report right here on YouTube and across the Global Star Radio Network. There have been many people wondering whose music is being played during those breaks. Well, you guessed it. And we're very pleased to announce that all that music and 11 brand new songs from the CD New Jerusalem is set for release on April 10th for download on iTunes. beans, you can help support my ministry and be blessed by this awesome, inspiring recording. I have been fortunate to work with some phenomenal musicians from around the world that helped us put this recording together in the studio. Simply go to joecharlesmusic.com and click on the iTunes link. Or, if you'd rather have a CD, we'll send one right out to you. Just leave me your email and we'll get right back to you. And thanks to Doug and Joe Hagman for making this all possible. God bless.
And welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. Our guest for this segment, was in the last segment, Jeff Ludwig. His book, Catastrophic Decline of the American Public High School. And it's a great topic because you see, there it is. Not that you can read the title from the camera angle there, but a lot of interesting places to go in this discussion, and it's definitely one relevant today as we see continue to see this decline in the educational value and the level of understanding the kids get in schools today, and it's even carried over into the college campuses. But let's start off with, Jeff, this segment with the nationalism versus globalism debate that we've seen increasingly become a point of contention in the news media and with the battle in the left versus the right.
Yes.
The left seems to think nationalism is, some say it's a white supremacy thing. Others, look at it as Hitlerian.
Yes.
But it's just the pride in your own country and trying to make your own country great, which is, I see no problem with that if that's the intentions. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, of course, I just agree with your whole take on the whole thing. And, you see, here is something that we should consider, this thing about nationalism. And that is that, originally, the idea of multinationalism really started to pick up under Woodrow Wilson with the League of Nations. But he was unable to sell it to America. And the Republican Party under Henry Cabot Lodge prevailed, and the League of Nations was defeated. And some people say Woodrow Wilson, who had a nervous breakdown at that time, it was partially because of the failure to win the Senate ratification. The two-thirds of the Senate have to ratify a treaty, and he failed to get that. The Treaty of Versailles itself was not ratified by the United States of America. Now, if you look at the schools in America, they are teaching that nationalism was actually a cause of World War I, you see. And this was Wilson's idea, that because all of these countries were too identified with their own nation state, that this is what led to the conflict in Europe. And this is what most high school textbooks are teaching and what most college textbooks are teaching, that nationalism was the cause of World War I, and nationalism, which was not stopped by U.S. membership in the League of Nations, continued to be the bane of Western civilization and world history. And this nationalism carried over and caused World War II. So this is the background of globalism, blaming nationalism for the two biggest wars of the 20th century. See, that's the context we're operating in. Now, let's look at the picture under a magnifying glass. And we see that in the treaty ending World War I, the Germans were asked to sign a war guilt clause. They almost left the negotiations at that point, but where could they go? They had lost the war. So they eventually signed the war guilt clause. So what I would propose is that Germany and Austria-Hungary were guilty of what should be called hypernationalism or chauvinism. they were guilty of starting the war. It wasn't nationalism as a general thing. British nationalism didn't cause World War One. French nationalism didn't cause World War One, nor American nationalism. So this interpretation of World War One being caused by nationalism would be incorrect. It was caused by the nationalism of the guilty countries. And likewise, World War II. It wasn't nationalism that caused World War II. It was the militarism of Japan. And it was the German idea that they had been wronged in World War I and they had to get even that caused World War II. And furthermore, Hitler had the idea of Lebensraum. Get more living room for everybody. Oh, everybody had to have more space in Germany because they didn't have enough ports and the population was expanding, all of that. He had a bizarre and overly aggressive view of nationalism. So the first thing we have to do is see that globalism originated in a false idea of nationalism and a false idea of the causes of the two world wars. So at the end of World War II, Roosevelt, and he had worked with Churchill on this in 1941, came back to his fellow Democrat Wilson's idea, because he was also under this kind of hypnosis that nationalism was the cause of these wars rather than internationalism or globalism. And so they set up the UN in 1945. They set up, as you know, the IMF, International Monetary Fund, to undergird the currencies of all the countries in the world, and the World Bank to for special projects to develop the underdeveloped countries. They use the term third world then, but it's out of fashion today. So
okay,
then globalism started, and I'm going on too long about it, I think.
No, please continue. No,
globalism started with those three vehicles, and it didn't seem to be a threat to nationalism, because hey, that's part of being a good American citizen. You help other people, you know, you get involved, you care, you reach out, and all of that kind of la-la stuff. But as time progressed, it morphed into something else. That's what happened. What started out seeming to be an innocent venture in cooperation with the peoples of the world morphed into what we are now calling globalism today, gentlemen. That's what really happened, because then gradually they had the Treaty of Rome and the European Economic Community, which became the European Union. You had the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, which is thousands of pages of rules about trade and so forth, which eventually became institutionalized as the World Trade Organization. You have as the African states became independent, various Pan-African organizations started. And the whole idea was regionalism and world organization. Regionalism working in tandem with world organization, and the individual states or bilateral alliances or trilateral alliances, it just didn't count as much anymore. What counted was your participation with many, many other countries in some kind of regional economic or even military structure. So even in North America, we had NAFTA, the Clintons instituted that, and so forth. So that's the kind of etiology or the cause and effect, snowballing, and then it gathers a momentum of its own. As we all know, once some things get started, it gets a momentum.
True.
And as I wrote in one of my recent articles, however, some of it is planned and some of it is unplanned. Like when I was walking across campus when I was in college, I was going to some kind of a meeting, and I was with Professor Price, who's a world famous chemistry professor. And he said to me, Jeff, I'm the president of the World Federalists. Now, this was in the early 60s. I'm the president of the World Federalists. I had never heard of them. And I said, what's the World Federalists? And he said, well, we want to see a one world government. Wow. And, you know, I didn't even know how to respond to that. You know, I was just a regular American guy, you know, trying to get through school. I never heard this in my life. But already, some of the brainy ones with this vision, this Wilsonian vision, were already working towards a one world government. And so part of this trend towards globalism is just the momentum. And part of it is various individuals, some perhaps sinister and some others who are themselves innocents in a way, sort of kind of silly idealists in some way, that don't appreciate the American experience enough or Western experience enough, in my opinion. They are all working in their spheres to move this along, and it got to this point where we are today, gentlemen, and to the listeners and viewers of this interview, I would contend that it's gone too far. It's gone too far, and there has been a decline of appreciation of the unique values of America, the unique contribution of American civilization, and the unique contribution of Western civilization to the well-being of the whole world, not just to exploit and dominate as the left would portray it, but to bless. Yes, there have been some downsides in all of this, but look at the blessings of Western civilization and American civilization upon the world. It's beyond belief. So when I heard Trump from the Rose Garden saying that we're not signing on to the Paris Climate Accord, and it just came at the end of his speech, the last two paragraphs, if one were to look it up, because we want to reassert, he used this word, reassert American sovereignty. Wow. I almost fell off my chair, gentlemen.
Well, you mentioned
reassert American sovereignty, and then to follow up on it. And again, of course, his critics, his insane critics, are carping and carping about every remark out of his mouth. They're carping and denigrating him. But then he followed up. I have to give it to him. He's a fighter. He reminds me of Charlemagne in some ways.
Good point.
He went to Poland. He reviewed some of the better moments in Polish history. At length, in quite detail, he was very, very generous to the Poles. But the beautiful thing was that by the end of the speech, he said, we're going to defend Western civilization. So the Paris Climate Accords was American sovereignty. The Polish speech was Western civilization. Are you happy about that? Are you as happy about that as I am? I was so pleased. Again, I had to rush and write an article about it. Because to me, this is, you see, whatever his shortcomings may be, we all have shortcomings. These are points I never heard, even from Reagan. Reagan is always being lionized by the right, but truthfully, I never heard Reagan just flat out say, we must defend Western civilization. Yes, he bombed the Libyan terrorists. I'm always grateful for that. He talked about mourning in America. I like that kind of rhetoric. But wow, look at that. We are going to defend Western civilization. And then they're mocking him because he referred to symphonies.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. You know,
yeah.
They don't go to symphonies anymore.
That's right.
That's right. We go to Carnegie. My wife and I go to Carnegie Hall sometimes. It's a great center for symphonic music. And, you know, we can't help but note that we see almost nobody under age 55 there.
Yeah, it's crazy. But Professor, I want to call you Professor Jeffrey Ludwig.
Thank
you. To me, you are Professor. But let me ask you this, or here's my observation. Joe, yes. I know you're going to say something. When you were talking about nationalism versus globalism,
yes.
And please tell me if this is an accurate assessment. I was thinking about this in preparation of our discussion, knowing this was going to be an issue. As you pointed out, really since the early 20th century, been on this globalist trajectory. And over the last 8 years under Obama,
yes.
And even with Bush and Clinton and such, but really the pedal of the metal under Obama, the globalist agenda was really in full force. And when Donald Trump came in, it was a moral, spiritual, cultural, and political whiplash. It was almost as if we hit, Donald Trump just yanked. Or I shouldn't say he yanked it, but the trajectory changed dramatically.
Yes.
America first. And to me, making America great again, America first, I those are slogans. I agree. But when the globalists feel that they are losing on the facts, they will assail us on the slogans by saying, well, that's pretty Nazi-esque, or that's what Hitler said.
Yes.
Is this what we're seeing? I mean, at the end of the day.
This is a rhetorical device, you know, of trying to malign the position of others, using a certain kind of loaded rhetoric to punish the people who are speaking about these issues of protecting America, our sovereignty, and our basic idea of rights, our basic Judeo-Christian values. And they're using this loaded rhetoric, which is... And frankly, you know, I don't really have an answer for this. Gentlemen, I don't have an answer for this, because this is why I'm always praying for our country. You see, it's so big, it's so critical, it's so hostile, it's so ignorant, it's so down and dirty, it's so vicious to be calling people Nazis who are saying America is the land of opportunity, not the land of exploitation. It's so vicious, it's so down and dirty to refer to those people who are saying the good of Western civilization and America far outweighs the bad. It's so negative that short of a violent response, because it's already bordered on violence, it's borderline violence. Somebody gets in your face and starts calling you a Nazi and bad names, you can feel the blood rush. If it were happening face to face, you would feel that person is about to attack you. Absolutely. If someone is sitting across from me and starts calling me a Nazi for my views and starts telling me that I'm full of it in the most angry, hostile way that he or she can, I'm expecting the person's going to jump on me at some point. So I feel, on the one hand, we're supposed to love our enemies, not only our friends. And I want to have love for all my fellow citizens. But at the same time, I don't want their ideas to prevail. I don't want them to succeed more than they have already succeeded, which I feel is too much. So therefore, I have recourse to prayer, and I must pray for a righteous turn. And I, despite his failings, his personal failings, and I believe the president has some personal failings, I believe that this is a turn, as you said, a jolting turn for the better. Where it's going to lead, I don't know, but I feel the pushback is essential. It's essential. This path of globalism, this path of tribalism. I just read an article by Victor David Hansen, who referred to the dangers of tribalism, where we start not talking about doctors. We talk about white doctors, black doctors, Muslim doctors, and we're thinking always in a tribalistic way. And he expresses his concern about that. This appeared recently in the National Review. So I don't want us to get into that mentality. You're media journalists. I don't want to call you white media journalists. I don't want to have to be thinking that Don Lemon is a black media journalist or whatever. I don't want to think this way. And I don't think the tradition of America is that way. So therefore, as I say, since I really do not have an answer as to how this crisis should be stopped or will be stopped, but I have to trust Almighty God in this situation, and I do.
And you know, at the epicenter is our Christian religion, and you noted here, it's no accident that the First Amendment includes freedom of religion, freedom of speech, and freedom of assembly, and so many freedoms. Historically, yes. You know, these grew over centuries. Elimination of prayer and Bible reading from public schools. Christianity is under fire in so many ways. The legalization of abortion, the homosexual marriage debacle, the vile and immoral storylines that we see on television, the out of control pornography labeled as free speech, this garbage is art that we see under the banner of free speech, the divorce rate, which is a consequence, I think, Joe, I think you'd agree, of the consequence of what we're seeing. The National Council of the Church is compromising the doctrines of biblical faith in God. All of these. This is really at the epicenter of this. This is where the problem exists, I think, that amorality is really taking over. And,
yes.
You know, and again, you write about it in this book here, in your book, folks, The Catastrophic Decline of American Public High Schools in New York City, Case Study.
I wrote an article a while ago when the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt burned down 80 churches, and there were some half-hearted apologies about that, and then the Al-Sisi government said they're going to rebuild those churches. I don't know if they've been rebuilt or not. But I wrote an article because I read the response of the National Council of Churches to that. And you know what their response was? I just hope, you know, you have some kind of something to hold on to on your desks, because their response was to pray for the Muslims who burned down the churches. And I just had to write an article about that, John.
Oh, Lordy. And that article is at American Thinker, I think, right?
Yes, sir.
Oh, my goodness. Pray. Okay, so let me get... Yeah, I got it. Oh, the air sickness bags.
This is where we are. And not only that, but they... Oh, they really went one better than the Protestants. The whole history of Protestantism, they got to be very Catholic. In their public statement, they said they're going to pray for any dead Muslims at the time. The souls of the dead Muslims.
Okay.
Yeah, right. Well, I don't... We're usually praying for the family members, you know. Once the soul is gone, we don't have the Catholic idea that you can have novenas and be praying that souls move from purgatory into heaven. That's a very Catholic idea. I don't know how it got into the National Council of Churches, but
yeah,
that's what they said. I'm not making it up.
Just wow. Okay. All right, but yeah, just wow. But see, boy, that really just threw me off because I really had something. I thought I really had something stellar to add to that. Well, no, you really
let me
with that. It really blew me off my center there.
It happens sometimes. Jeff, we got
more
about
than not.
We got about a minute and a half till the break. And I want to thank you so much for coming on. I want to ask you real quick, and if you can summarize this in a short minute, the changing of history that we see in the school system today.
Yes.
Is that something that's going to continue, do you think?
Yes, there are people working against it, and the advanced placement exam in U.S. history was modified, actually. Different, more conservative, but highly respected scholars pushed them, and they did modify the exam to reflect a more accurate, less left-wing view of American history. But there's still a ways to go. And again, we just have to stay in prayer about this because in the immediate future, there's not going to be a change because the major software publishers textbook publishers like Cengage, Houghton Mifflin, and so on, they're on board with a more left-wing interpretation because it sells. It sells. The big cities buy it, and they have 50,000 books.
That's insane.
In New York, you know? So they want to make the money, and it keeps going.
It's amazing.
Jeff, thank you so much for coming on tonight.
Yes.
A fantastic interview. We're already
out of
time.
Well, you're so welcome. I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you and your listeners and viewers, and it's a great honor, John.
Now, people can get a hold of you via your articles at American Thinker, correct?
Yes, or there's a telephone number they can reach me at onprayer.com if they need to talk to me.
I'm sorry, onprayer, O-N-P-R-A-Y-E-R, onprayer?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Onprayer.com.
Onprayer.com. Beautiful. Thank you so very much, Jeffrey Loeb. God bless you, my friend. And please come back and visit with us.
Thank you. I would be very honored and pleased to do so.
All right.
All right, folks. We'll be right back.
Good night.
Night.
Thriller predicts the future. In 3 days in the belly of the beast, Daniel Holdings wrote about the God particle before CERN actually discovered the God particle. In As the Darkness Falls, Daniel wrote about an Islamist terrorist confederacy that rose up out of Syria and declared a caliphate 3 years before ISIS was ever heard of. In his newest novel, Between the Veil, Daniel talks about a space between dimensions where supernatural beings can walk. He says that these novels are a warning from the Creator to his creation. Will war come to America? Will the world's economies collapse? Are we looking at increased earthquakes and volcanic activity? Will the United States fall into civil war? You can find all of Daniel's work at his website, danielholdings.com. That's danielholdings.com. All of these things and more are talked about in Daniel's books. To find out what's coming next, go to danielholdings.com.
Worldwide demand is making coconuts one of the highest yielding cash crops available today. Coca-Cola, Pepsi, and many high net worth individuals have invested billions of dollars into coconuts for strong growth and solid long-term income. Yields could be as high as 18% or more per year. Capital appreciation and exceptional income for up to 60 long years would be an absolutely brilliant investment to pass on to future generations. Diversify wisely with direct ownership of fully managed coconuts on prime farmland close to the beautiful Costa Rican border. For more information, qualified accredited investors should go to profitsincoconuts.com or phone 855-888-6288. That's 855-888-6288. This announcement does not constitute an offer to sell securities or a solicitation of an offer to purchase. Offer made by prospectus only. 855-888-6288 or visit profitsincoconuts.com. Profitsincoconuts.com.
You may never look at your city, town, or its people the same way ever again. Stained by Blood, a murder investigation based upon a true story by private investigator Douglas J. Hagman. Using the character Mark Stiles, Hagman takes you on a journey behind the scenes where the homicide becomes a secondary to an underworld of satanic ritual abuse, child abduction, and even mind-controlled experimentation. For 5 years, a brutal killer remained on the loose, free to kill again. As Mark struggles to navigate
investigate a maze of bizarre twists and untangle a web of deeply hidden secrets kept by some of the most powerful and influential people in this community and beyond. Stained by Blood. Order your copy of this engaging novel today at HagmanandHagman.com and click on the link. Stained by Blood at HagmanandHagman.com and click on the link. Stained by Blood.